Today is Friday, so my co-host is Benham Ben-Talabu. He's a senior fellow at Foundation for Defense of Democracies, where he focuses on Iranian security and political issues. And Benham is an expert on the militias, Iranian strategy, and so much more. Benham, happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Good to be back with you. Greetings, listeners.
Yes, Benham, always great. I look forward to my Fridays. Let's get at it. We have talk of regime change in Israel by an American senator. Okay. Reuters has an interesting report about a meeting between Hezbollah and Iran. Houthi attacks continue. The Houthis also made an interesting claim that they could target ships beyond the area, the Red Sea, Bab el-Mandeb Strait, and the Gulf of Aden. The Iraqi militias have remained silent. And then we'll quickly go over what's going on with the pier and U.S. airdrops for humanitarian aid into Gaza. Benham, let's start with regime change discussions. Senator Chuck Schumer from New York made absolutely astounding comments on Israel. He said the only option towards a two-state solution is to oust Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. I just find it ironic, American politicians who worry about absurd, ineffective information operations on Facebook and the internet, Russian attempts to influence election, are openly calling for regime change, not with an enemy, with Iran, but with one of our best allies. What are your thoughts on this, Benham? What is going on here? Is this complete madness or what?
Yeah, holy cow. If you're in Tehran, you got to be sitting and smiling because you got U.S. Yeah. senators more willing to talk about regime change in Israel than in regime change in Iran. People who are too afraid of the Iraq example or so easily moved into the Russiagate online world, now applying all of those stops, talking about a major U.S. security partner in the region, and talking about that partner not amid a judicial crisis with Bibi has had, not amid a corruption scandal, which Bibi in the past has had, not amid ongoing negotiations, which Bibi in his previous capacity has engaged in, but amid a war. At the helm in Jerusalem is a unity government, not just Bibi and not just people to his right. It doesn't look good for the United States of America. And it just reminds me of this line that, particularly when I get to speak to government folks, I'm often trying very hard to repackage and remind them of, because I think, step number one towards any good policy is do no harm, the Hippocratic Oath. You want to make sure you're doing more positive than negative on balance. And the line I remind them of is the Soleimani line from 2010 in Iraq that first got published and translated 2013 in Syria in a major profile of him by Dexter Filkins. And that line was, we're not like the Americans. We don't abandon our friends. And you don't want to add Bibi Netanyahu to a line of people that, begins with the Shah, has Mubarak in the middle, and Bibi Netanyahu at the end. Not a worthwhile impression for us to be sending. There's a whole domestic politics element to this as well. There's demographic and geographic changes within the Democratic Party. There's an electoral strategy here. There's a thought of some folks saying all politics is local. There's another thought about folks saying all politics is fringe politics. He may be playing to fringe. He may be playing to different constituencies. Who knows? But I think regardless, it's a highly, and I'm being respectful, it's a highly irresponsible statement. And I will tell you, one can have qualms with the way Israel has prosecuted its military response after the October 7 terrorist attack. There are respectable ways to have those conversations, particularly between nations which have such deep friendship like the U.S. and Israel. But also, we should really beware of those who use their criticism of anti-Israel and anti-Semiteness as merely, they kind of sugarcoat that as being anti-Bibi. And this has afforded their anti-Israel and anti-Semitic views. And I'm not throwing those words around lightly. I'm the last one in Washington to throw around these fingers. But all I'm saying is buyer beware that folks who have had these views are now candy coating it in a view that is much more palatable, which is the anti-Bibi view. And that's not at all what I'm saying about a major, critical, historic Jewish-American senator from the state that I grew up in and lived and had the honor to live in until I was age 18. That's not what I'm saying. But that statement that he said can provoke more of this thing that I fear. And again, I think I find it to be more hurtful than helpful.
I agree. And, you had noted, Benham, that this is a unity government. And one of the people, I guess the darling that seems to be emerging amongst the Democratic Party seems to be Benny Gantz, right? And he's a member of this unity government. Now, did anyone really believe that if he replaced Netanyahu, that things would radically change, that he wouldn't be under the same pressures and demands for an operation to finish off Hamas in Gaza? You know, if Gantz really was against what was happening, he has the option to resign. It would send a massive message to the Israeli establishment, but he hasn't. And I don't think, you know, this dislike for Netanyahu, which began years ago, and some of it's understandable. I mean, look, I don't profess to be an expert on internal Israeli politics. You know, there was recently an article out, I think, within the last week, I want to say, where aides or people close to the Biden administration were saying there's a visceral dislike of President Biden to Netanyahu. And this reminded me of Biden's, you know, announcement of the withdrawal from Afghanistan. He also had a deep dislike of Ashraf Ghani, the last president of the government of Afghanistan before the Taliban takeover. One, I have to wonder how much this administration or Biden are influenced by their personal dislikes versus the actual policy itself. And if it was only this simple, if it was only as simple as let's get rid of Netanyahu and all of this will fix itself, I have a feeling that's far from the case.
Particularly if it was a statement made about the peace process. I think you read that and gave it some pretty important context that, you know, he's saying this as someone who wants the two-state solution. You know, I personally think regime change in Iran, a country that has, or a regime, the Islamic Republic, which has impeded the entire quest for the two-state solution by playing on downtrodden and dispossessed Palestinians. You know, the Iran-Hamas relationship, even though PIJ, which is newer than Hamas and was formed much more so in Iran's image, and now we're getting into proxy world here, the Iran-Hamas footsie began post-Madrid or amid-Madrid, the first of these series of peace process conversations, when Iran realized through some arms and through some stoking and ultimately through material and political support, it could use disaffected Palestinians as a spoiler. So understanding that linkage and dealing with that rather than, you know, this point of finger at a partner who you don't like would be much more productive. But I don't want to get too far into it.
No, that's fine. I'm going to ask two rhetorical questions here. You have no obligation to answer. And then we'll move on. You know, is Senator Schumer talking about regime change in Gaza? Why not, you know, Hamas? What about its responsibility in this war? And why is it that if you mention regime change with respect to Iran, you're a neocon warmonger? But if you mention regime change with respect to your ally, Israel, who's in a, you know, gone to war only because it was forced to after 1,200 of its citizens were murdered horrifically and, you know, hundreds were kidnapped and, you know, more than 100 still being held, you're a hero. I know you can't answer those questions, Benham, so we'll move on.
Well, actually, here's how I won't answer it, but I'll footnote it, or I'll put an exclamation mark next to it, or I'll underline it three times imaginarily. It reminds me of this Persian saying, which is harfi hisab javab nadare, which means the weighty words or the cost words or the words that convey weight have no response or require no response. So what you said were some weighty words, and they require no response. Our silence, the reader, the listener's silence, my silence up until now when I ran my big mouth again, is proof of how important what you said was.
Yeah, and Benham, I think I have you on you're my co-host on Fridays just for your Persian statements of wisdom. I really enjoy them. So,
you know, my family actually listens to this podcast, and my mom says, Why do you find the need to just stretch everything to the point of where you can weave in one of these maxims? But I was like, that's an art.
Because I love it. So that's what, Mom, if you're listening, that's why. So, Benham, this morning, Reuters published an interesting report about a supposed meeting between Hezbollah officials and Iranian officials. Tell us about this. What's going on here? What's the import?
So the headline essentially read as a proxy trying to assuage, take care of, tamp down, placate a patron. In essence, the Reuters story, which is alleged, which is again very highly sourced. There are about six or seven sources the Reuters piece mentions about a meeting between Ismail Ghani, the head, the commander of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps Quds Force, and Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Lebanese Hezbollah. Essentially, with the Hezbollah telling the Iranians, you know, listen, if there's a conflict, we got this. I'm giving you the kind of condensed Brooklyn version of both the story and the commentary that came from the story. But this is coming a bit about as, you know, there has been no Ramadan truce. There has been no Ramadan ceasefire. The more successful Israel is, you know, we're 2 out of 3 in terms of big cities in Gaza. If they go north, and the deterrent situation there is changing on a daily basis. The weapons both sides are firing is changing on a daily basis. The target set geographically is changing on a daily basis. This is 2 of 3 of Herman Kahn's types of escalation. So this is textbook definitions of escalation, even though both sides have kind of hinted that they don't want to escalate. If Israel does feel the need to engage in more deterrence by punishment, and if Hezbollah does continue to broaden the kind of targets that they're firing at and use different weapons, use heavier weapons, more longer range weapons, more precision strike capabilities, what have you. Or perhaps, God forbid, diversify and go more into the maritime domain. They could take the strategy that Iran created in the Persian Gulf and Strait of Hormuz that the Houthis have perfected now in the Red Sea and the Bab el-Mandeb, and then add in their capability to mess stuff up on the Eastern Med. You know, that really would require a multi-domain response, perhaps not just by the Israelis, but other forces in there as well. So it is amid all of this talk of a wider war, of a matter of when, not if, Israel is going to have to go into Lebanon, that, of course, Iran is worried because Lebanese Hezbollah really is the crown jewel in terms of the proxies. It is a proxy that has helped Iran train militia forces in Iraq, in Iran itself, in Syria, and, of course, in Yemen and in Syria. The decisive entry of Lebanese Hezbollah in 2013, fighting conventionally alongside the Syrian army, supported by irregular paramilitary by Iran, as well as later on Russian air power after 2015. You know, this was a very toxic, powerful combination that allowed Assad to remain in power literally to this day, up until 2024. So all of this aside, is Iran is trying to figure out thresholds for its own potential involvement, more direct involvement in any of these conflicts. You've seen a wind down of some of the Iraq and Syria attacks, but you've seen a wind up in terms of the Houthi ones in the maritime domain. And the big question mark is, not the ones affecting the Americans, Iraq, Syria, less so Jordan, not the ones affecting the global economy, the Houthis in Yemen, but the ones directly with the knife against the neck of the Israelis themselves, Lebanese Hezbollah. What will be the fate? What will be the status of that? Particularly as you hear more and more and more kind of legal discussions coming from Israel about Resolution 1701, about the lack of Lebanese state enforcement, about the lack of international community enforcement, about the lack of UNSC enforcement, about the lack of American enforcement, and perhaps most importantly, as a force that some have floated in the past as a potential counter to Hezbollah, about the lack of Lebanese armed forces enforcement of 1701. In the absence of all of that, and with a threat like Hamas bogging Israel down like we see post-October 7, imagine what a threat like Hezbollah could be and would be doing. And then you put the cherry on top of that sundae, the domestic situation in Israel, the economic contraction, the dislocation, the downgrading of the credit rating, the having 300,000 to 360,000 plus permanently mobilized, the 80,000 plus from the north internally displaced. What will it take to get back to normalcy? Perhaps some hope through deterrence by punishment, perhaps defanging Hezbollah, perhaps moving them back. And it is amid this entire category that Iran may try to say, at what degree is Israel going to respond to save face, to move its citizens back to the north? To what degree is Israel going to be defanging Hezbollah? To what degree do I need to resupply them? To what degree do I need to activate more proxies to get involved, to save them? And to what degree, if they're going to get curb stomped, do I have to more overtly intervene? And these are all more questions than answers. But the fact that Lebanese Hezbollah is telling the Iranians to calm down may mean that they have some read as to the Israeli comfortability or the Israeli threshold or the Israeli political will to carry out a campaign that may not be a third Lebanon war, but that may be something more limited.
Yeah. And, you know, on that last point with, you know, Senator Schumer's comments and the Biden administration's discussion of red lines if an operation occurs in Gaza, in southern Gaza and Rafah. If I'm the Hezbollah, I think I'd feel pretty confident to assure the Iranians at this point. One quick point, you had mentioned, you know, what else could Hezbollah do? And the underwater drones that the Houthis have been attempting to deploy, and by the way, which the Ukrainians are very effectively employing against the Russian fleet in the Black Sea. A lot of problems in that war for the Ukrainians, but that has been one striking area of success. That is something that really worries me. If the Hezbollah feels that it's losing in one area, maybe it could bolster in others. And, you know, there's this big fat thing that's being built off the coast of Gaza, will be being built within the next months. We'll get to that, you know, the humanitarian aid gear. Are we going to be prepared to defend that? I'm not saying that that's you know, what Hezbollah is talking about here. But as you were talking about this, what are the options for Hezbollah? That one really came to mind. If Hezbollah got into the business of target of maritime targets, just look at how effective that has been with the Houthis. And I think that's a great segue for us to move to the Houthis, who are continuing their attacks near daily. Anti-ship ballistic missiles, anti-ship cruise missiles. They sunk a ship within the last, what, week or two? Just a continual. The updates from U.S. Central Command or CENTCOM are daily, and the U.S. is destroying. So, Ben, I have one question on that. Do we have a gauge on how many anti-ship and anti-ballistic and cruise missiles that the Houthis possess? Do we have any idea? Because I'm reading daily press briefings, and they're saying we destroyed 9 today and 18 yesterday and 4 the day prior, and it starts adding up, and we've had to have taken out hundreds of targets combined, and yet they're still, the Houthis are still launching near daily attacks.
You know, I could do a back of the envelope calculation for you, and this is not a Persian maxim or technical term here, but it's a blank ton. And no one has the right answer. No one has the right answer. Even on the things that we have precise numbers for, we being US, but I mean, also in this instance, USG has precise numbers for, they've been very reticent to share some of these numbers. Every year, for instance, a lot of the Iran-related numbers that you see come out in, you know, detailed kind of database-style reporting, whether you look at IISS, military balance, or whether you look at Jane's, I think these are more rounding errors now for what the capabilities these countries have, you know, Iran's ability to surge in terms of the production. There was one time, for example, former CENTCOM Commander McKinsey talked about a back of the envelope number, I think 3 to 4 or 3 to 5 thousand for short range and medium range, just surface to surface, just ballistic for Iran. That was 2020. I think that was much more on the low end than what already exists. The Houthis, again, had an arsenal. The Iranians augmented the arsenal. There is both in, you know, in-country kind of welding, in-country production, in-country assembly, as well as things that they may get from the Iranians and whole systems that come in different parts. It would be impossible for me to really give you a number. I would not be shocked if you'd look at their entire anti-ship arsenal and you don't have a very, 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 very low 3 or 4 digit number, a very, very, very low 4 digit number. So I would say 1,000 plus.
Yeah. And that's really what that's the number in my head is thousands, right? Because we've destroyed hundreds and they've launched hundreds. And I am not seeing I'm not seeing them, at least at this point in time, ceasing or drawing down attacks. They seem to have a pace to these. So that's what leads me to believe thousands as well, Benham. Yeah, that sounds about right. And the Iranians, it's a good investment. They should, if I'm the Iranians, I keep sending them. I send them everything I got because these systems, the Houthis are willing to take the blows, which aren't really, you know, again, I think my biggest complaint with all this is we're not targeting Houthi military personnel who are launching these. They should be hitting the barracks where they stay, should be hitting the, you know, the command centers, and we should be targeting Houthi leaders as well, because you could replace weapons, but, you know, capable individuals who know how to fight. And also, by the way, the Iranians advisors that are there as well and engineers, they need to be hit as well. But the U.S. likes to go after things and not people these days, and it's a big mistake. And that's I think, a big reason why this targeting of the Houthi targeting continues.
There are some things that could be hit. It might be a question of resources, or I think more realistically, resources for ISR. So more ISR, but more money and more capability and more time for that ISR, which is the vast majority now of things being fired are anti-ship ballistic missiles. Yet we've gone for some things that are a bit smaller. And for the ASBMs that they have, you need the TELs. You know, these are copies of, you know, Iranian variants of single stage solid propellant short range ballistic missiles that the Iranians have retrofitted with, you know, seekers, radar homing, or electro optical. And that's what's gotten the targeting a little bit better over time. You have to basically fire something that goes high and fast at a already fast moving target. There are lots of targeting challenges there. But moral of the story is that you need a TEL for this. So what, you know, as hard as it is to have a number on the missiles, what is the number of the launch vehicles? I don't mean just like truck mounted stuff for these smaller drones, the Waid drones, which is, you know, their version of the Shahed drone, even though Delta Wing drones were first seen in Yemen before they were seen in Iran. But that's a different story. To get the stuff that goes the furthest, what do we need? What do they have? Why are we firing at the things that are the undistributed middle between the people that launch them the weapons that are the launch, that are themselves being launched, and the infrastructure that houses them. The connective tissue there is the TELS, the transporter, erector, launcher. If we take out, if there is one sensitive piece of this entire chain, it is neither the missile, nor the people, nor the warehouse. It is the TEL. And I know that is an act of God to have to spend the people in NSA and anywhere else and doing SIGINT and IMINT and the other people taking in the live data from the increasing but still limited ISR we have there are probably like, God damn it, this guy's going to make me sit here 48 hours a day to make me find one truck or one thing that looks like a truck. But that is going to be the key. And like with all intelligence work, it's never the sexy, shiny object. It's never the smoking gun. It's the daily collection, the slow, steady trudging through of boring, mundane things that allows you to establish patterns and trends and find what is the diamond in the rough and to find these pieces. So that's, you know, my piece of advice to USG on this. And there is no winning with it, but we can make the investments now to hurt them the most.
I just got back from CENTCOM down in Tampa the other day, and I know they are working hard on solutions, and this really is a big one for them. It's a big problem for CENTCOM, and I know the people down there, again, working real hard to try to get to these problems. I think of what you're saying, and if I'm listening to you, I'm thinking of like an air defense system, right? You know, you have a lot of launchers and the missiles, but if you want to get the key item there, go for those radars or hit that command truck with the guys that are actually launching those missiles. You know, those missiles are useless if they can't be guided. And I'm, you know, sort of making an analogy there. I don't know what the...
No, I think that's the perfect analogy. And you just reminded me, because you said like an air defense system. Remember a former FDD colleague, and he was doing a lot with you at LWJ as well, Patrick.
Yes.
Patrick McGann. We looked a lot at the S-300. When the S-300 was finally given by the Russians to the Iranians, this, you know, advanced surface-to-air missile defense system that had essentially three different units. And obviously, you know, we came to that conclusion. We talked about what weapons would be good for suppression of enemy air defense, destruction of enemy air defense, the integration of this with the patchwork of foreign and domestic SAMs. But again, all of this stuff makes the Iranians sound 10 feet tall, but you can lock onto that one truck, that one radar truck, that one that does the targeting. You can confuse them with electronic warfare and then go after them and neutralize them with a JDAM or something. It's game over for the whole system. So that is the, you know, the application of this theory.
Yeah, maybe if those ships that are providing intelligence from the, you know, the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden and the Iranian intelligence ships, maybe if they were taken out, that would help things too. And, you know, again, we just...
Yeah, why do you think we were, the, you know... Either I wouldn't say, I don't want to put me and the regime on the same page, but like, why do you think I laugh? And I'm sure the regime itself is also laughing when you have a lot of American analysts, some who have lived through, again, the Iran-Iraq war in the 80s, talking about America is going to go or America should go and hit all the oil vessels at Karg Island and the oil tankers. I was like, we're not even targeting the, the one ship that's the mother load of this. And there was one alleged story of a cyber attack. If so, we're not going to go kinetic on this. What in God's name do you think we're going to go kinetic for? And this is the Middle East, which still the definition of an interest is what you will kill, fight, and die for. It's not a recommendation to kill, fight, and die, but the definition of an interest is what is worth it. And if we will not establish to the adversary, let alone to the American taxpayer who needs to know what is worth it, because for the American taxpayer, they see the region as a junk bond. I don't want to say rightly or wrongly so, but we haven't delivered the goods. And more importantly, DOD is behind the cost curve on trying to get rid of these Houthi munitions with, you know, $2 million, I don't know how many million dollar SM-2s and, you know, what kind of Tomahawks and other kind of capabilities we're firing at the Houthis on land and still not crippling this network.
Yeah, it's absolutely. And look, you know, this is to me isn't a military problem, although the issue of what we're using is really. You know, watching the war in Ukraine, right, the use of drones to take out systems, and yet you just said it, we're using $2 million weapon systems per, you know, per hit to destroy launch sites. Now, maybe some of them were using JDAMs, still hundreds of thousands of dollars on those bombs, right, or tens of thousands. It's not the people, you know, like sometimes I think what we talk about here gets confused with, you know, I think some people in the military may get upset with us. Look, if the administration would take the gloves off, they can achieve their mission. They'd also have to make sure to get them better tools, right? I think we are behind in, you know, using drones as opposed to, you know, less or more expensive weapon systems, but neither here nor there. If we went after the right things, if we were given the green light, I know the military can execute that. And that's got to be a really frustrating. It's frustrating for us sitting here on the outside. I could just imagine being on the inside, sitting there as an analyst and going, I need to hit this, this, and this. And they're like, oh, no, you can't do that. You could hit this, this, and this, but that's off the list. And the point that you made, you know, what we're not doing, what we're not hitting, sends a far bigger message to the Iranians about our wills and our capabilities than what we are hitting.
Amen.
Another interesting story came out. The Houthis recently said that they can target ships beyond the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden, obviously the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, which connects the two. Tell us a little bit about this. Are the Houthis blowing smoke here, or is this a credible threat?
Like all great things, there is some smoke and there's some credibility, and it's just the lines for the two. And I'm using the word lines there carefully because there's no lines in the ocean that precisely tell you where the Gulf of Aden, which follows the other side of the geographies you painted, where that formally ends in the Indian Ocean, which, you know, the Gulf of Aden is part of the entranceway to the Indian Ocean, where that begins. So the way I look at this is the Houthis are signaling that they can escalate in terms of geographic distribution. Now, it'll actually be harder for them to actually launch more hits, you know, to actually land more hits, I should say, because it's going to be firing. You're going to have a wider distribution radius of what you need to be firing at. There are more ships concentrated in a smaller position in places like the Bab el-Mandeb and the Red Sea, which is traditionally what makes them choke points. Firing at oceans, you know, that's the stuff like Battle of Midway. You need the big lumbering kind of conventional architecture to get you across these geographic bodies and then pose a credible conventional challenge once you get to the other side of it. I think the Houthis can certainly project power in terms of harassment power. You know, minimum 650 kilometers for some of the stated ranges of these anti-ship ballistic missiles. The anti-ship cruise ones, you know, they'd be maxing out 250, 300. There are Iranian claims from a few years ago of having taken the progenitor for the anti-ship missile that they ended up giving the Houthis. The Iranian one is the Khalij Fars, later on the Hormuz 1, Hormuz 2. Both built off of the Fateh 110 system, the ones that the Houthis have been parading in 2022, 2023, particularly the ones with the finlets and the seekers that look like the Iranian copies of the ASBMs, they call those the 10-kil. I would lock that in about 350 to 650 kilometers. So instead of firing it from northern Yemen or from southeastern Yemen, southwestern Yemen, if they're able to go further into the south and southeast, which, by the way, that's AQAP territory, and there is an entirely different movement there with the Houthis and AQAP. To what degree does AQAP give them permissive jurisdiction so long as they're firing at someone they don't mind being fired at? Raises all these other questions. But if you manage to somehow, putting all of that aside, go to the south-southeast, yeah, you can target the entranceway of the Indian Ocean. I don't think it's going to be as effective. But again, this is Houthi signaling. And I think there's at least four phases of the Houthi campaign here related to October 7. Phase one was the clearest phase, which, if you ask me, this is what I think they were going to be most comfortable with. But the Israelis were so successful at sealing off their territory, probably with PAC-2, Arrow 3, F-35, F-16, and who knows what else, other kind of expensive fighters or expensive, you know, air and missile defenses. They prevented the Houthis from landing MRBMs, LACMs, and one-way attack drones. Then the Houthis shifted to the major maritime campaign in the Red Sea and Bab el-Mandeb. And then there was that footnote, so it was the third one, which I still have some disagreements with, over the capabilities the Houthis may have, whether they're targeting the terminals or formally cutting the cables. The Red Sea is much, much, much deeper than the Persian Gulf, so it can't be something the Iranians gave them one-to-one, but these really are state-level capabilities, cutting these internet wires. That's phase three. Phase four is, you know, broadening the geographic distribution beyond the bodies of water that immediately touch Yemen. So this is the Houthis continuing to dangle the prospect of a growing threat so long as they don't get what they want. And what they want is that ceasefire. And even if you give them that ceasefire, there is a chance the Houthis will turn this off. But what you have vindicated for the acts of resistance is that they can turn it on whenever they want. And there is no Saudi campaign to defang them. And I don't know if friends and listeners got to watch or listen to, I think, several weeks back now, perhaps in early February or late January, there was a Yemen hearing on the Hill. Someone whom I respect and who is such a gentleman and a scholar, and every time I've met with him, I've learned a ton from him. Ken Pollack, now at AEI, he was testifying at, I think, the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Middle East Subcommittee on Yemen. And he devoted a lot of his time to the need for some kind of local armed force on the ground, that this is fundamentally about territory and the territory they control. And we will be dealing with the symptoms. And whatever the next manifestation of the symptom is, if they went from trying to target Israel to targeting the Red Sea to targeting internet cables to now targeting the Indian Ocean, who knows what the next one will be. And this entire thing is brought to you by old world politics. They control territory. They can extract resources from the territory. They can make alliances from the territory that they control. They got a state patron. They got bigger territory. They're a bigger fish now. And if you vindicate the political strategy to which they're applying military ends towards, give me a ceasefire, I'll stop firing on you. Then the question tomorrow is, if we even care about strategy and anything beyond an electoral cycle, what else am I going to be firing these things at?
What are they going to ask for next? Right?
Exactly.
What are they going to demand next? You know, it's safe haven. I mean, it's true for terrorist groups. It's true for states. You know, say, you know, we like to call the Houthis a militia or a terrorist group or this or that. The fact is they run all the trappings of a state and they have a military. You know, one quick point on the capabilities. Like, look, it seems to me they have this, the weapons systems. The hardest part about hunting ships in the ocean is I don't think people really understand the vast distances. And this is, and I'm by no means a naval warfare expert, but I do know this, you know, aircraft carrier groups can evade satellites if they know how they're operating, right? So we can hide from the Russian, our fleets can hide from the Russians can hide from us. It's more and more difficult the more and more satellites get up there. I don't know what capabilities the Yemenis, right? That's why that ship that's plying the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden, the intelligence ship, it's providing targeting information. Would they get that from the Iranians? If they could get support like that, but even then, the distances are so vast, I think it would be difficult, but not impossible. But it's as you said, Benham, they are signaling. They're issuing that threat for a reason. And I'm going to tell you what, we should take them seriously. After what we've witnessed for the last 2 months, there is no reason we shouldn't take the Houthis seriously about any threat they issue at this point in time, because clearly they have the equipment to do it to some degree, and more, they have the support of Iran, and most importantly, they have the will to do it. You know, we have all the equipment in the world, and we just don't seem to have the will to take the fight to the Houthis the way it needs to be. And again, not a military problem. If you're in a warship in the, you know, Gulf of Aden or the Red Sea, and listen to this, I'm not pointing the finger at you. It's the political leadership does not have the will to go after the Houthis as needs to be done in order. And I agree. There needs to be a ground component to this. Controlling territory matters. It's key. It's why, how did Hamas conduct its attack on Israel?
Permissive jurisdiction. They had the whole strip. People turned blind
eyes. Because they had a safe haven and they, all the trappings of a state, and they had sponsorship from Iran and from other, you know, from other terrorist groups.
And that's the Bill, you touched the connective tissue between state-state relations, state non-state relations, you know, mid-power terrorist group, great power ties, because it does come down to territory. And I'm not going to go academic and stress the importance of realism here, but this is one reason why realism is still applicable as an international relations model, because it cares so much about territory. And you go to these academic conferences and you go to these DC think tanks and people mock you for realism or mock you talking about territory. What are you, some like Duke from the medieval period? Yeah. You're trying to extend your principality. This is the 21st century, Benham. Get with it. No, this, you know, old school is best.
We can win wars in cyber. We can win wars in economic wars. How's that working out for us?
Yeah. The shoeless guy just, you know, beat us. And not
right?
The shoeless doesn't mock your enemy, but like, because that is also a problem we have, you know, mocking, deriding, belittling, removing of agency of the adversary. These are all, you know, warfare is as much art, and within art, there is discipline and respect. We cannot forget about that component.
You know, I know you listeners are tired of hearing me, you know, use Afghanistan as an analogy here, but they didn't just beat us. They didn't beat us military. They didn't beat us on the ground military, although they did beat our proxy there, essentially the Afghan military, right, or our ally there militarily. Yes, that happened. They beat us politically. They beat us at the negotiating table. They used all of our tools, all of the things that we value, you know, peace talks and negotiations and you know, incentives, and they turned the table on us and used it to get us to leave the country in order to implement their military solution. And people still refuse to recognize this. And some of the same things are happening. You know, I know we said we didn't want to discuss this, and we don't. I'm just going to mention it. We're essentially at war with Iran and its proxies throughout the Middle East. And this administration just frees up $10 billion of cash for the Iranians to access. I mean, of course, we're going to lose this war. if this is how we fight, they're, you know, as you said, the Iranians are laughing at us, and they should laugh at us, because why should they take us seriously if we don't act seriously?
And this is not to make them, both the Iranians, sound like Bismarck or Kissinger or Clausewitz or Sun Tzu, or to make, you know, Rambo 3, the Afghan one, you know, that everybody in a terrorist safe haven is some kind of glorified, you know, fighter and whatever. But your comment there about fleshing out they didn't beat us militarily, they beat us politically. This is the gaping hole in our strategy, because even before we get to resolve and will and interest, and we have obviously the balance of capability in all of these conflicts essentially on our side, it's how we deploy it. It's what we choose to use, what we choose to restrain, the time we choose to invest in it, the resources we choose to invest in a certain capability, the attention we pay to a certain area. These are all political things. And my problem with the Middle East is that we don't have a political strategy. Sometimes people say, Behnam, you're blank footing around the region. You keep talking about diplomacy. I don't mean diplomacy as in terms of like you need to sit down and reward them like the Biden administration just did. I mean, we need to be mature diplomats about this. And what that means is, again, you don't need to sit down and talk to everybody all the time and think that's going to solve everything. But we need to take a measure and also know what we care about and put those military resources towards what we care about. We can't prioritize for the American taxpayer, let alone for the adversary, what we want, what we care about. Look at the continuing resolution drama. Look at how we choose to fight partners who are fighting conflicts that we are interested in, whether that's Ukraine, Israel, or anywhere else around the world. This is a political deficit we have. We have a political shortcoming. That's one. And I think I'll hold off on the other. But there's a real political problem.
Yeah. And Benham, I don't pretend to speak for you. I'll just speak for myself here. It's not just a problem with one party. It's a problem I see with both parties.
Yeah.
This is a bipartisan problem. We don't have a coherent foreign policy that I can tell, at least not one that's been executed by both parties since, I don't know, two decades now, maybe. Maybe am I being too harsh, or am I being too kind? But you know, it's really hurting us. Well, look, Benham, let's finish up on, you know, I'll just mention it real quick. The U.S. is going to build a humanitarian pier off the coast of Gaza. It's, you know, a lot of questions about this. But one of the things, what have we learned since this was announced last week? The U.S. has some ships. They're in transit to build these. It's going to take about a month for them to get them. I think they made headway this week. I think they're off the coast of like North Carolina right now. So about a month for them to get there. They're slow moving ships. I watched something on this. They move around anywhere. I think they have to move around 11 knots or about 11 and a half miles per hour. It's quite a ways to go. Meanwhile, that's just to get there. And then it's going to be probably take weeks, if not a month or more, to assemble. We still don't have answers on how this is going to be secured. The Biden administration says troops won't be on the ground. I don't know how you connect a pier to a beach without someone stepping foot on land, but I guess we're going to find out. I find this one to be very difficult to believe. And who's going to secure this thing? The Israelis would be crazy to do it after what happened a week ago, which we're still trying to sort the facts out. There's no win for the Israelis there. There's no win for the U.S. here, because there's still the U.S. As long as the U.S. is arming Iran, the pro Hamas crowd, and I'm going to call them that. If you say anything remotely critical or question anything remotely critical about U.S. or Ukrainian policy, you're pro Putin and pro Russia. So I'm going to call those who criticize, you know, who are going to say, you know, the Israelis are the problem here. Let's just call them pro Hamas. All right, maybe I'm wrong here, but that's just me venting a little bit. We need to know how this is going to be secured and how aid is going to get across and who it's going to go to. But I got to tell you, the Israelis are insane for even allowing the prospect of feeding your enemies while you're at war. And the reality is the Israelis are at war with Hamas, which runs Gaza. And that's just the reality of the situation. People will say, no, the Palestinian people have nothing to do with this. civilian populations get caught in the middle of wars all the time. There you go. I'm a Neanderthal. I said it. But Benham, any, you know, after my inflammatory marks here, any thoughts on what's going on here? Does this even seem sustainable to you? Do you think? Oh, and one other thing. The U.S. has launched, has now conducted 11 airdrops. And here's the numbers. This just came in this morning from CENTCOM issued a press release. In those 11 airdrops, 35,700 U.S. meals ready to eat. And 31,800 bottles of water. I don't even know who they even, why is that even attempting that? They're not, there's 2 million people, you know, so that's 2 million people live in Gaza. It just, all of this seems very futile and wrongheaded to me.
Listen, I haven't been following the Pure story as closely as you, but I will say this, a couple of quick points. One on the humanitarian side, yeah, it certainly is odd and ahistorical, to put it mildly, that you would feed a population in the same jurisdiction that you're fighting a war in. But at the same time, this war is very different. There's the politics component to it. There's an optics component to it. The Israelis already, they're coming in at a D-minus on a good day on those fronts. I certainly think there is utility in trying to fight that optics fight and also do the right thing. Again, one wonders the standards to which after this conflict, any country, particularly the West, particularly America, is going to be held to. Let alone the tactics or the capabilities that will be able to be made possible or not possible, or the arguments by opponents of a conflict that will be able to have an audience precisely because of this kind of stuff. So again, the humanitarian impulse, you know, bless them, this comes from the right place. Everybody understands that, Israelis, Americans, Arabs, whomever. But, you know, war is hell. And that's why everything should be done to prevent a war. And that's why stemming conflict, even through limited and judicious use of military force, doesn't make you a warmonger. It makes you someone who understands how much hell war is, that you don't want it to come to this day, where even the prospect of feeding someone has to come with, is this going to look like a Normandy beach invasion? Or is it look like what happened with either the US or the Jordanians or the Qataris? I don't know who it was, where even food airdrops are killing people. So what a tragedy of errors.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one thing I don't think people understand, first of all, the people with the guns in any siege situation, which is essentially what Gaza is, are always going to get the food, the medicine, the gas, and the goodies first. So we know this is going to Hamas. U.S. official even admitted it's such and said, well, we can't do much, but it looks good. And
I didn't see that.
He didn't say it looks good, but that's at the end of the day, that's what it's all about, right? And I'd be all for that. But the reality is the Israelis are never going to earn any goodwill from any of this. And this is why it's a mistake. Sometimes it just pays not to play. If I felt the Israelis would get 1 ounce of goodwill from this, I'd be all for it. But they're just going to be accused of something else. And if there is an incident where there's some type of riot and a lot of deaths due to it, the Israelis are going to be blamed for it. They're going to be blamed because they didn't allow aid, because of this, because they didn't secure it, because they didn't approve this. It will come back on them and it will come back on the United States anyway. That's just the game that the Israelis and we can't win. It's just the cards are all stacked against them.
Yeah. The optics environment is, as you mentioned, stacked against them. What I will say, though, also for the prospects of whatever else may come down the pike in Gaza or whatever other kind of military conflict the Israelis may have, it's good for like a running list of these things that seem ahistorical and definitely unstrategic to be documented. If I was an Israeli, I would certainly be documenting this. And to have it as like a running list of the things they've done that is odd or ahistorical for a war zone, particularly a modern war zone, particularly an urban warfare war zone, which, you know, if they were wise, could be used in other ways. I think it would be, that would simply be good to have of, here's the things we've done. Not even to compare it. I don't like, you know, quite frankly, the comparisons to Mosul. I think that's quite unfair.
Yes, absolutely.
And different too, but also unfair. So I think having this, rather than have your partner, the Israelis, have to denigrate their partner, the Americans, over humanitarian issues in a different urban warfare war zone, having this as a list of things that they've done and can point to while having and being forced to fight in a different urban warfare war zone could take off not just some steam, and even if not that, can disarm the other side of a more nefarious argument. Because when you do step out and see how ahistorical this is, that allows us to, and perhaps we can end on this, go back to this Persian saying of they don't pass out sweets during wartime. Well, clearly they must pass out ready to eat meals during wartime.
Which, by the way, will have sweets in them. I can tell you that from firsthand experience. Benham, you know, it's excellent points. You know, if I felt that, you know, look, I mean, I recently saw someone at a protest. I can't remember if it was here in the United States or elsewhere, but the poster literally said, "Rape is resistance."
Oh my
God. Never going to convince people.
I hope to God that was not in America, but that's bad to hear anywhere.
Right. I mean, it you can't appeal to people that have viewpoints like that. There's just nothing you can do to get them on your side. And frankly, that type of viewpoint is far too prevalent here.
But there are ways to stop own goals, you know, that both America and Israel's diplomatic strategy with the Egyptians and the Jordanians has to be better. We can't have let them gone to be this unhelpful. We can't have let them to weaponize every argument against any kind of Israeli military operation in Gaza. We can't have let them gone that far. And the way you do that is to not give your adversary ground to stand on and to talk about these things. Because again, those guys aren't supposed to be our adversaries. Egypt and Jordan get tons of U.S. military aid. They're supposed to be countries that have, and indeed still do, knock on wood still, their peace agreements with the Israelis. They're supposed to be the cornerstones of the pro-American order in the region. So when they start going off and you have no diplomatic strategy towards, and again, the principle, the imperative of diplomacy, you need to, one, do no harm. Make sure you've got to triage your own side. And I think this can go a long way to potentially triaging their own side. But the optics of setting this up on the beach and not touching the beach and God knows.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. The diplomacy needs to be better. And like, you know, it would just be helpful if people just, you know, didn't say such harmful things. But they're going to because they're playing to the crowd. Well, let's end it there. As always, great having you on Friday. I enjoy these conversations and I greatly look forward to it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Pleasure.
And have a great weekend. Also to you, the listeners, everybody enjoy the weekend. It's getting warm here on the East Coast, and I'm looking forward to getting outdoors. Thanks, everyone, for listening to today's episode of Generation Jihad. Just a reminder, you can listen to us on YouTube, Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you listen to podcasts. Please subscribe to Generation Jihad and leave us a review, preferably a positive one, but only if we earned it. Thanks again, and we'll see you all again real soon.